From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Defense Attorney Robert Shapiro put together the O.J. Simpson Dream Team and was the team's lead strategist. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Shapiro about the trial. He was eventually replaced by Johnny Cochran as lead attorney, and the team was fractured over strategy. Shapiro has written a new memoir called The Search for Justice. Also, another courtroom story about a lawyer who spent 9 years and went broke suing two corporations for allegedly poisoning a town's well water. An obsessive writer spent 9 years chronicling the story of the obsessive lawyer. The resulting book just won a National Book Critics Circle Award. We'll talk with writer Jonathan Haar. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Searchers at the plane crash site in Croatia have identified the body of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. President Clinton telephoned Brown's wife this morning with the news. All 33 people aboard the Air Force plane died in the crash yesterday. White House spokesman Mike McCurry says the president has issued an executive order to honor Brown.
He is ordering that flags be flown at half staff at the White House and at all public buildings and grounds, at military posts and naval stations, and on naval vessels of the United States government through April 10th.
The president joined administration officials at a brief memorial service for Brown at a church near the White House today. Mr. Clinton's public schedule has been canceled today, including the planned signing of the line item veto bill. Despite claims from Croatian officials that the plane carrying Brown had equipment to record either cockpit conversations or flight data, the Pentagon insists that the plane had no such gear. Investigators will try to piece together what happened to the flight. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The Croatian prime minister told reporters that he believes there was a so-called black box on board the military T-43 that went down near Dubrovnik. But in Washington, General Howell Estes said the Pentagon has made every effort humanly possible to find the answer to that question.
The answer we get back continuously from people who are responsible for this aircraft is that it was not equipped with either.
Estes says the plane was originally purchased as a training aircraft, so no recording equipment was included. The general confirmed there are no survivors and that 33 bodies have been recovered. There were 35 names on the flight manifest, and the search for remains is continuing. The one woman who was found alive but died en route to a hospital was identified as a crew member. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
Criminal charges will be filed today against the man authorities believe is the Unabomber, but the initial charge might not be directly related to the 17-year string of bombings. The suspect is Ted Kaczynski, a former University of California, Berkeley math professor who lived like a hermit in a mountain shack in Montana. NPR's Nina Totenberg says authorities are sure Kaczynski is their man.
They seem absolutely confident that they finally, after nearly 18 years, caught their man. He matches their profile in every way imaginable, both where he lived, starting out in the Midwest, then to the University of California at Berkeley, also having been spent some time in Utah. He matches their profile as to occupation. That is, he is a mathematician with a PhD in mathematics, but also as to psychology. He is a recluse, a hermit on the hill, as his neighbors call him, in the remote area of Montana in which he lives.
NPR's Nina Totenberg reporting. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 6.5 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A former general manager of Daiwa Bank's New York branch has pleaded guilty to helping hide $1.1 billion in bond trading losses from federal authorities last summer. The plea agreement resolves the last criminal charge in the Daiwa scandal. Daiwa was evicted from the U.S. in February and paid the largest criminal fine ever imposed against a financial institution in the U.S. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has begun his official campaign for re-election in June with a trip to a provincial town south of Moscow. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports from Moscow.
President Yeltsin left Moscow for the countryside, apparently determined to shake off his image as an ailing, remote figure out of touch with the lives of ordinary Russians. He said he was planning to meet local people in the provincial town of Belgorod and find out how they live. Mr. Yeltsin's aides have been nagging him to make more public appearances and rediscover the common touch, which has always been his trademark. The elections are now just over 2 months away, and opinion polls still put Mr. Yeltsin well behind the communist leader Gennady Zyuganov. The prospect of a Zyuganov victory has alarmed many Western governments. Mr. Zyuganov is an open admirer of the Soviet dictator Stalin. In recent interviews, he said that more people are in Russian prison camps today than during Stalin's repressions. He also said the government's current economic reforms have brought about more suffering than World War II.
The BBC's Andrew Harding. A Russian warplane on a reconnaissance mission has reportedly been shot down over a village in Chechnya. The Intervax news agency says the pilot managed to eject safely. A researcher at the University of British Columbia is warning people to be extra careful when driving next Monday. Dr. Stanley Corin has found that traffic accidents increased by 8% on the first workday following the start of daylight saving time. The problem, he says, is the hour of sleep that gets lost in the process. The change to daylight saving time occurs this weekend. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Shapiro, is the defense attorney who assembled O.J. Simpson's dream team. He's written a new memoir about the trial called Search for Justice. Yesterday, we talked with Christopher Darden about prosecuting Simpson. Darden says the trial left him furious with the jury, the judge, the media, the defense, the whole country, and he's given up practicing courtroom law. As a member of the winning team, Shapiro isn't complaining that the legal system let him down, but he is critical of some of the strategies other members of his team, F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran, used to win the case. Shapiro is now a partner in a Los Angeles law firm. I asked Robert Shapiro if he truly believes Simpson is not guilty of the double murder.
Terry, that's one of the questions that I focus my book on. And what I am concerned with as a lawyer, as a professional, is legal justice. And legal justice takes place in a courtroom under the rules of procedure and professional conduct. And in this case, there clearly was a correct verdict rendered by the jury in that there was reasonable and real doubt.
But you're not willing to say, I firmly believe in my heart that O.J. didn't do it.
You're asking me a moral question. I wasn't there. You weren't there. Beliefs are personal. Beliefs are moral. And I'm a lawyer. I'm here to weigh and judge evidence and present it in the best way I can to a jury. And in this case, we did just that, and the jury reached the correct conclusion.
Cato Kalin is now saying he thinks O.J. Simpson did it. What's your reaction to that?
Cato Kalin was the first witness that I interviewed, and I interviewed him the first day I was retained on the case. I tape recorded that interview. It took place over about an hour, hour and a half, and asked him some very, very compelling questions. At no time during that interview did he ever suggest what he's saying now. I turned that interview over immediately to the prosecution. I had no obligation to do that. He testified in the trial and never testified to anything like that. Perhaps now, for some reason, he either has changed his mind or looked at things differently. He's entitled to his own opinion just like anyone else.
As you know, Christopher Darden from the prosecution has a book out about the trial as well. And one thing you both agree on is that Johnny Cochran played the race card. I'm wondering if you talked with him about that during the trial.
Yes, I did, Terry. It was very interesting. Mr. Cochran and I, you know, were together night and day during this case. And I had always said race should not and would not be an issue in this case. Johnny said, Bob, never say never. I'm a product of the 60s. I was involved in the civil rights movement. And I was really, really concerned about the race issue being brought up in this case. I thought this might be a case where, because I was a white lawyer representing a black man accused of killing two white people, that this might be a symbolic way of bringing the races closer together. I couldn't have been more wrong. But we had lengthy discussions about it, and Johnny's position was, Bob, you have not been a black man in America for 50 years. You have no idea what it's like. Race affects everything in America. So we had long and very, very heartfelt discussions about it.
Did you feel that when he used race in the trial, he was using it for reasons that he really believed in, or did you feel that he was using it cynically to manipulate jurors?
You know, I really don't think it's fair for me to speculate on what his motives are. What I did do immediately after the verdict came in the first interview and the first time I really had been interviewed at all during the entire trial, I had no interviews. I said what I felt, and I said what I said to Johnny right after he made the arguments and right after the verdict came in, and that is, I don't believe that race should have been an issue. I thought that bringing it up could have really backfired, and that asking for jury nullification because of past wrongs to African Americans from slavery till today is not appropriate in a murder case.
Have you spoken to Johnny Cochran since the verdict?
No, I have not.
What about Effley Bailey?
Effley Bailey I have not spoken to really since December of last year. And then when he remained on the team over my strong, strong objection, and when I offered to resign if he continued to remain, that the only conversations I've had with Mr. Bailey concerned things directly related to the case. I had no other conversations with him whatsoever.
And what was your biggest problem with him during a trial?
Well, I had several problems with him. I thought that he was pompous. I thought he was arrogant. I thought he was not being effective in his examination of witnesses. I also felt that there were numerous stories that were being leaked to tabloids, clearly coming from defense sources, and in one particular example where the original interview with O.J. Simpson and the Los Angeles Police Department was tape recorded, that somehow got leaked to a tabloid newspaper. I was set up to appear to be the person who had done it. Those stories were leaked in the press in New York. The story did appear in the tabloid, and the leaks suggested that I was paid $5,000 to leak this confidential tape recording. Fortunately, a very distinguished journalist in Los Angeles, who is also a professor of journalism, Bill Boyarsky, who writes for the Los Angeles Times, called up the editor of the magazine and said, regarding the tapes that you acquired, I've just got to know, was it Bailey or Shapiro? And he printed the answer. I can tell you this, it wasn't Shapiro.
One more question on the actual defense team. During the trial, at O.J. Simpson's request, Johnny Cochran became the lead lawyer, and you became more of the overall strategist. So that you had been the lead lawyer. You were the first lawyer on the case. You put the team together. Do you feel that the direction of the defense changed when positions within the team changed?
Well, it certainly changed in that no two lawyers conduct a case the same way. And the person who was in charge of the trial, as Johnny was, had a different strategy, a different approach than I would have taken. What we do is an art. It's not a science. But O.J. Simpson and I, when this team was put together, had decided early on that after the preliminary hearing, if he was going to be facing a trial, and we knew he would be, that we would bring in another lawyer who would be the lawyer who would be responsible for the trial aspects of the case, and I would remain, in the words of some others, as the quarterback.
When O.J. Simpson was charged with two counts of murder, the district attorney's office called you, and you promised that O.J. would give himself up promptly, although you asked for a few more hours than the D.A. was willing to give you. Then O.J. disappeared. What went through your mind before you even knew about the slow speed chase?
Well, it was clear to me and clear to everyone who was present at that time, which included four doctors, that O.J. had gone to kill himself.
Why did you think he was suicidal? I don't mean what was it about his mood, but what do you think his motive would have been then?
This is just my speculation, Terry. He is a person who is very, very concerned about his image. He's the type of person who gets dressed to go pick up his morning newspaper out in front of his own house. The fact that anyone could even think that he was involved in a murder, I think, was devastating to him personally.
Robert Shapiro is my guest. He's written a new book about the O.J. Simpson trial called The Search for Justice. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Shapiro. He's written a new book called The Search for Justice. There's an accusation now of jury tampering, that the juror Francine Florio Bunton was the target of somebody who wanted this juror off the case because it was felt that she might vote against O.J. Simpson. So there was an anonymously sent letter by someone who claimed to be the receptionist at a literary agency. And the letter said that this juror's husband had approached the agency saying that his wife, the juror, wanted to write a book about the trial. And the assumption was here that she was going to hold out and vote his O.J. Simpson's guilt. So Judge Ito took her off the trial after this letter was received. Do you think that this letter is a sign that there was, in fact, jury tampering?
First, Terry, let me just correct part of what you said in your question, that she was removed because of this letter. She was not removed because of this letter. This letter set into action a process where every juror was brought in, and Judge Ito had done this on many occasions whenever there was any allegation or suspicion that something was amiss with the jury. That after everyone on the panel had denied any association with a book or with a literary agent, Judge Ito told each juror, do not discuss this conversation with any other juror. And they all were sworn to do that. The very last juror that was called in was an alternate juror. And just as she was finishing her interview in Judge Ito's chambers with all the lawyers present, Judge Ito said, is there anything else you'd like to tell me? And she said, you know, there was something a little bit strange. I saw one of the jurors reading a newspaper that had a written note on it. Immediately, Judge Ito sent the bailiffs into the jury room to bring back every piece of paper in there. And he found a newspaper. And on that newspaper was a handwritten note that said, he is asking or he is going to ask you about the book or a book. And that was crossed out. Every juror was then brought in. Do you know anything about a note? Did you ever see a note? Francine Florio Bunton said, no, I never saw a note. I know nothing about a note. Said, did you ever see a newspaper? She denied it. Then Judge Ito had that newspaper and confronted her with it. And after she was confronted with it, there was not one person in chambers, either from the prosecution, from the defense, or from Judge Ito's team of attachés that believed she was telling the truth. And there was no objection to her being dismissed.
Okay, so okay, maybe, let me get back. So maybe she was dismissed finally because of this deceit about the newspaper. Do you think that the letter itself was a sign that somebody was attempting to tamper with the jury?
That's a different question.
Do you have an opinion on that?
First I saw the piece on 60 Minutes, and the allegations could not be more serious. And if their facts are correct, an investigation is certainly warranted.
Robert Shapiro is my guest. He's written a new book called The Search for Justice. One of the things that really worked for the defense was when one of the prosecutors, Christopher Darden, had O.J. Simpson try on the bloody gloves and they didn't appear to fit. But before that demonstration, the defense objected. Why did you object?
Let me tell you what the sequence of events was. We had a sidebar, one of innumerable sidebars in this case, where Chris Darden said, I'm going to ask O.J. Simpson to try on the glove.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Cochran objected, and I think that was a proper objection. Many objections are made for the record to protect legal issues. And the legal issue here was it was a demonstrative type of evidence that perhaps should not legally be admissible. That argument was quickly dismissed by Judge Ito, and his indication was that he would allow it. At that point in time, Chris Darden took their glove expert, Richard Rubin, from the witness stand and brought him to counsel table in open court. Rubin wanted to look at the gloves more closely. They laid out butcher paper and brought the gloves onto the table. Rubin put on plastic gloves at this order of Chris Darden and Sherry Lewis and picked it up and examined it like it was a piece of ancient Egyptian tapestry, even though at that point in time those gloves had no more evidentiary value of any real significance since they had been examined and handled by at least 20 different people. I then asked to examine the gloves and was told I could. I did it right in front of everyone and was also instructed to put on the rubber gloves, which I did. But I did something that, to my knowledge, nobody had done, and that is I tried the gloves on.
How'd they fit?
My hand is a medium, and I'm about 5'10". I have probably a smaller hand, yet the fingers were just a little bit large, the wrist was a little bit wide, and I knew at that moment that those gloves would never fit O.J., but I didn't want to take a chance. So I put the gloves right back down. I turned to Johnny. I said, try on the gloves real quickly and put them down. And then I went into the lockup. The bailiff, Guy Magnera, was there, and I went to O.J., and I put my hand against his hand, palm to palm. And I looked him in the eye, and I said, these gloves are not going to fit. I want you to go out because Chris Darden's going to ask you to try them on. And Johnny's going to object, but Judge Ito is going to allow it. And go in front of the jury and pull on those gloves as hard as you can and hold it with your hand in front of the jury as if you're holding the Olympic torch because the gloves will not fit. And you know what, Terry?
What?
They didn't. And everybody in the courtroom knew that.
So did you think of this as a big turning point for you?
It certainly was a major, major turning point in the case.
Were there disagreements within the defense team about how far to go in calling the police investigation a conspiracy against O.J. Simpson?
Absolutely. There were discussions about everything.
Can you give us a sense of what the discussions about that specific issue were like?
Well, there were some who felt that the conspiracy issue was a viable theory, was one that had to be raised, and was one that had some substance. But the theory was never, as reported in the police, in the press, a massive police conspiracy where policemen in mass, along with the chemists and the coroners, all got together and decided they were going to go out and frame O.J. Rather, those who favored bringing up the conspiracy argument were talking about one or two individuals, along with perhaps one person from a crime lab who could have planted or manipulated some evidence or played with the evidence. My personal belief was that the conspiracy theory was not a viable, strong theory. I did not believe we could convince a jury that the Los Angeles Police Department, the crime lab, and the coroner's office got together and decided because O.J. Simpson was an African-American that they were going to frame him for this murder.
And what did you think you could convince the jury of?
Exactly what we did convince the jury of, and that is that from day one, because they acted hastily, because they came to conclusions before the evidence was even analyzed, that they had an officer named Mark Furman, who Chris Darden said he didn't believe and wouldn't call as a witness, yet they called him and tried to embrace him. They tried to paint him as a poster boy, as an all-American. They had a lead detective who said that he and three other detectives left the crime scene and went over to pay a condolence call and notify O.J. Simpson of the terrible deaths. I didn't think that was credible whatsoever. They had a car, a Bronco, that supposedly was secured at 7 a.m. That morning, and yet we had photographs at 8 and 9 o'clock of civilians actually touching the car where the blood was supposed to be found, and press people spilling coffee on the hood, and the car was broken into over a period of 3 months. We had a lead detective who inexplicably took a blood sample from O.J. Simpson, the only reference sample, and rather than walk down the hallway and book it into evidence or take it 3 minutes away to book it directly in the crime lab, put it in his pocket and drove it out to the crime scene and had it for 3 hours, something he'd never done in 25 years. When you start going through the case piece by piece, there is reasonable and real doubt in just about every aspect.
Robert Shapiro has written a memoir about the Simpson trial called Search for Justice. He'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Vision, a direct-to-desktop customized news service. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Robert Shapiro about the defense strategy in the Simpson trial. Also, the epic legal battle that nearly ruined the lawyer who took it on and the author who wrote about it. We talk with writer Jonathan Haar. Last month, his book, A Civil Action, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Shapiro, the defense attorney who assembled O.J. Simpson's defense team. Shapiro has just written a new memoir about the trial called The Search for Justice. One of the many dramatic points in the trial was F. Lee Bailey's cross-examination of Detective Mark Furman on the subject of whether Furman used the word nigger. I asked Shapiro why it was Bailey and not Johnny Cochran who cross-examined Furman.
I felt Johnny Cochran was the best lawyer to examine Mark Furman. At the preliminary hearing, as you recall, before I brought Johnny on board, Gerald Ullman and I did the preliminary hearing, and I went up to Mark Furman the day he testified, and we knew a lot about Furman at that point in time. And I looked him right in the eye, and I said, "Mark, today's your lucky day." He said, "Why is that?" I said, "Because I'm not going to cross-examine you yet." We wanted to hold back. My feeling was that Johnny, being an African-American, would not be in an awkward position and would have tremendous impact if one time and one time only he asked him, "Have you ever used the N-word?"
But Cochran didn't want to do that?
No. He felt that he shouldn't do that. And you'll have to talk to him about what his reasons were.
What did you think of how F. Lee Bailey handled it?
Well, clearly we brought out what we needed to, and that was that Furman denied ever using the word, and we had, at that time, civilian witnesses to impeach him. We did not know that we had a tape recording with words out of his own mouth. I thought Lee's examination was pompous, was overbearing, and until he got to that one instance of the use of the N-word, he repeated it and repeated it ad nauseum in a loud and hostile voice, and it made me very uncomfortable in the courtroom. I thought the rest of his examination was not up to the standards that I would expect from a lawyer of his caliber.
What would you have done different?
I think I would have tried to bring out the real credibility issue with Mark Furman. I would have tried to bring out that Mark Furman himself said, "I'm not fit to be a policeman. I wake up in the mornings and I want to go out and break bodies, bust bones. I can't control myself." And then I would have brought out the fact that a psychiatrist for the city examined him and said, "No, Mark Furman's faking to get a disability. He's either exaggerating or lying." And then I would have argued to the jury, "This is a man with no credibility. He can't be believed. He can't be trusted." And when the tapes came out, clearly this was an issue that would have to be examined. But again, my emphasis would have been on credibility, not on a racist cop that was out to frame somebody, but rather an officer who was a rogue, who had virtually no credibility whatsoever, who had clearly lied on the witness stand, who found every piece of important evidence and could not be believed.
Judge Ito gave O.J. Simpson a chance to talk at the very end of the trial, although the jury was not in the room to hear it. Why did you want him to have a chance to talk? What points did you want him to get across, and did he have help in preparing his comments?
You know, I can, as a lawyer, take you into a room, but I can't reveal attorney-client privilege conversations. Judge Ito wanted to put on the record that O.J. Simpson gave up his right to testify as a witness, and that is commonly done. O.J. Simpson went beyond directly answering the question and put forth his own views.
Did you ever want him to testify?
This is the most difficult decision a criminal lawyer has to make and the most important advice a criminal lawyer has to give. Because clearly, no matter how many times we talk about the presumption of innocence, that the burden of proof is on the prosecution, that the defense does not have to prove anything, and that the defendant, if he doesn't testify, it can't be held against him. My general feeling is people want to hear the defendant testify. However, if I am successful in talking to the jury during the voir dire and getting them to really understand the concepts I just talked about and getting them to honestly believe that they will not hold it against the defendant if he doesn't testify, it is my preference in most cases that a defendant not testify for several reasons. Number one, the witness chair is the most difficult chair in the world to sit in, especially if you are accused of a crime. If you appear nervous, people can think you're lying. If you appear agitated, people can think you're lying. If you don't show enough remorse, people can find that to be offensive. We saw, Terry, in this case, the best witnesses in the world, not only police witnesses, but expert witnesses, who testify as part of their profession, who are trained to testify. And yet when they get on the witness stand, some of them look foolish. Dr. Irwin Golden, after I cross-examined him, I thought was left with absolutely no credibility, to the degree that for the first time ever in a trial, the prosecution didn't call the doctor who did the autopsy. Witnesses can make mistakes. You saw the greatest expert in statistics get up and say, I've made a mistake, and I'm going to have to live with this the rest of my professional career.
So you think your client risked looking bad no matter what the truth was?
Exactly.
Just by the very act of being a witness?
Absolutely.
So you didn't want him to testify?
It was my advice that we could not and did not make that decision until all of the evidence was in.
And but there was a time when O.J. would have liked to testify.
He wanted to testify throughout. Mm-hmm. And you can see what type of person he is. He wanted to talk to the police the first day he was arrested. He wants to talk to the public today, and he has another trial pending. But other lawyers on our team said publicly that O.J. Simpson definitely would testify.
Everybody has the reaction to the swift jury decision, a jury decision about 4 hours after they started deliberation. Briefly, what's your interpretation of that swift decision?
It's one of the reasons that the public has not accepted the verdict. And it surprised me. I expected 2-3 weeks.
Or a mistrial.
4 weeks. Well,
I mean, a hung jury is what I mean.
My suspicion from the beginning of this case was that O.J. Simpson would not be convicted,
right,
that the worst we would ever have would be a hung jury.
So let's get back to the swiftness of the decision and your interpretation of it.
People really paid very, very close attention. They followed it on a day-by-day basis. This jury paid great attention. Clearly, they formed opinions as to the credibility of the witnesses as they were testifying, as they should, and didn't seem to have a difficult task in deciding the case.
My guest is Robert Shapiro, the defense attorney who assembled O.J. Simpson's defense team. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Shapiro. He's written a new memoir called The Search for Justice. After the trial, with O.J. Simpson still facing a civil trial, right after the trial, he called Larry King live on the program. He nearly did a network TV interview. More recently, he released a video. Have you counseled him at all about how to behave publicly in the aftermath of the criminal trial while still facing the civil trial?
No, I haven't. And the reason I haven't is because I am not involved in representing O.J. Simpson in the civil case or in any other legal matters. My representation of him was for the criminal trial, and it ended the day the verdict came back.
And what did you think of his public appearances and the video? Do you think that's why?
I've represented high-profile people throughout my career. And whether you're high-profile or low-profile, one thing I always advise clients against is speaking on their own behalf. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever a good idea, especially when litigation is pending.
You've represented a lot of celebrities, not just O.J. Simpson, Christian Brando, Johnny Carson, Rod Stewart, Jose Canseco. Do you think celebrity law is a whole type of law unto itself?
Yes, for this reason. Because you are required to go beyond being a lawyer and really be a media representative. The minute a charge is brought, if you are representing a high-profile person, the detriment and negativity attached to that can ruin their career regardless of the outcome. And it's very important that the celebrity have a spokesperson who can at least put the matter in proper perspective and, if nothing more, encourage and plead with the public not to jump to any conclusions until all the evidence is in. Generally, what happens is the prosecution comes forward first. The chief of police will come on when he's never come on a case and talk about the arrest of a prominent person. And then the prosecutor will get up, and they will all tell you what a strong and fine case they have and how there will be a conviction and how they will not treat this case any differently than any other case. And then you end up with something like O.J. Simpson, where in any other murder case there'd be two prosecutors. Here there was 45. There would be two detectives. Here there were 100 policemen. There was the FBI. There was Interpol. There was three different independent crime laboratories. Enormous resources. We also had to build up enormous resources, but couldn't come close to what the prosecution had.
One last question. I think after the O.J. Simpson trial, a lot of people reached a cynical conclusion, which is that the verdict in a trial depends on how much money the defendant has to hire the best defense possible. What do you say to people who believe that the verdict is so related to the amount of money you can spend on your lawyers?
Well, first let's look at the circumstances here. Would anybody else in this type of case be faced with this type of prosecution? Absolutely and unequivocally no. This was the most intensive and extensive investigation ever done. So in order to even have a chance to get a level playing field, you had to have a client who had the financial wherewithal to put together the best defense and the best experts that were available. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been any chance. So to that degree, it was important that the client be in a position where he could economically afford such a defense. But it was only because of the way the prosecution brought the case on. I generally feel that people in the public eye are treated much more harshly and investigated much more thoroughly with much more in resources. So they have to be able to gear up and fight back. Having said that, certainly better lawyers do better jobs across the board. And that's no different than if somebody goes to the county hospital here in Washington, D.C., or somebody can hire a world-famous surgeon to come in. One may get better medical care than the other. We have horrible cases here in the United States where people without money get no representation whatsoever or get inadequate representation, and it's terrible.
Robert Shapiro's new memoir is called The Search for Justice. Coming up, the story of an attorney who nearly destroyed himself obsessively pursuing the case. First, some music from a courtroom drama. This is from Duke Ellington's score for the film Anatomy of a Murder.
Thank you.
Music by Duke Ellington from Anatomy of a Murder. This is Fresh Air. While the major figures in the O.J. Simpson trial published their memoirs, another book about a much less celebrated legal case has just won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. This book is called A Civil Action. It's about a lawyer named Jan Schlickman who obsessively pursued a case for about a decade and nearly destroyed himself in the process. A perhaps equally obsessive journalist, Jonathan Haar, followed the story over the years, never knowing exactly what kind of book he'd get out of it. The lawyer, Schlickman, took on a class action suit in 1986, representing 8 families in Woburn, Massachusetts, who were suing 2 major corporations, W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods. I asked writer Jonathan Haar to describe what the lawsuit was about.
Beginning in the late 1960s and throughout the 1970s, the children of East Woburn began getting sick, largely with leukemia. They got sick and they died, and it was a plague of almost biblical dimensions. As it turned out, 2 wells that supplied water to the eastern part of the town were contaminated with toxic waste, with industrial waste, primarily trichloroethylene, a solvent used by industry. And 2 companies had plants near the wells that provided East Woburn with water. And those companies had, the case was essentially about whether those companies had dumped waste that had gotten into the wells, and whether that waste had caused the illness in East Woburn. These families wanted some answers, and they weren't getting answers from public authorities. They needed a lawyer, and they found one.
You know, in some ways, this lawyer seemed, at the beginning of the case, to almost embody some of the stereotypes, some of the negative stereotypes so many Americans have of lawyers. Big ego, ostentatious style.
Yes. He was all of that. He was a kind of classic product of 60s idealism and 80s greed and acquisitiveness. When he took on this case, he was in his early 30s. He wore $1,000 suits. He had a Beacon Hill duplex. He drove a Porsche. He told me, what he wanted to do in life was to get rich and famous by doing good. And that's why he took on the case. He thought it would do those things for him.
This case ended up nearly swallowing up Jan Schlickman, who was representing the families that were suing the 2 companies. How did it swallow him up?
It destroyed him. It really did. He lost his Porsche. He lost his Beacon Hill condo. He was sleeping on a fold-out couch in his office. I was in the next office over, sleeping on a fold-out couch, watching him. The case consumed enormous amounts of money. During the trial, the telephone to the office was cut off at one point. He had to borrow money. He had to walk to work. He could no longer take a cab, and he'd lost his car. He devoted everything to this case. He became obsessed with it. He simply wouldn't let it go. The fascinating thing to me was that this guy, who seemed to care so much about money and so much about the good life, was willing to sacrifice it all in pursuit of what he felt was truth and justice.
Did ego have to do with it, too?
Ego, I think, played a large role. Certainly initially it did, when he believed he could win. Afterwards, when he simply wouldn't give up, it was in his gut, I think.
When he was bankrupt and lost his Porsche and was sleeping on his couch in the office, did he try to keep up appearances in court so people wouldn't know how bad things were going?
It was a big issue with him. The one thing he insisted on having done was getting his suits out of the dry cleaners. He was also very superstitious in a lot of ways. It was kind of funny to watch him. He had certain lucky ties, and he had a lucky suit, and he had to have that suit the morning of the final argument. The dry cleaner wouldn't give it to him because he owed them $180, I think it was. He finally convinced him. He persuaded the dry cleaner to give him a suit, and he won his first argument of the day.
Now, they could have made a whole lot of money on the verdict. What was the verdict?
The verdict was that W.R. Grace was liable for having contaminated the wells, and the jury exonerated Beatrice Foods from responsibility. W.R. Grace settled for $8 million after the verdict, and of that sum, some $400,000+ went to the families. The rest went largely to pay case expenses and legal fees. In the end, Schlickman took only, I think it was $30,000 for his 8 years of work on the case and went off to Hawaii on a vacation. But what he didn't realize then, after the verdict, was that he would spend the next 4 years pursuing an appeal against Beatrice Foods. The lawyers for Beatrice Foods had concealed documents and destroyed evidence. And Schlickman spent the next 4 years trying to get that verdict reversed and trying to get a new trial against Beatrice. And that's when he really plummeted. That's when things really began to go badly for him.
Did he succeed?
He succeeded in finding the truth, I think. He didn't get justice. In the end, he went off to Hawaii again, vowing never to practice law. He essentially lived the life of a beach bum for a couple of years, essentially penniless, living in dilapidated motels and camping out on beaches.
This case went on for years between, the pretrial work, the suit, and then the appeals and so on. So it was about 8 years. That's an enormous amount of time for you. Did everything else in your life get put on hold?
Well, this was my life. I actually came into it in 1986, just as the trial was beginning. 4 years before that, leading up to the trial, was the discovery process, which I was not there to see. I reconstructed that through people's memories and through depositions and transcripts, pretrial transcripts. I was there for the following ensuing 4 years. When I first got a contract with Random House, I thought that it would take me about, 3 years to write the book. That was my first contract. I had 5 extensions on the contract in all, and I didn't have enough money either. I ran out of money. But I'd taken Random House's money, and I felt like I had to get the book done. So in all, it took me 8.5 years. I didn't finish until late 94.
Yeah, I think a real problem in writing a nonfiction story that takes 8 years to resolve is you could get so trapped in the detail.
I was for a very long time. I think that I had 50,000 pages of documents of transcripts, depositions, trial testimony, and court filings, in addition to some 100, I think I more than 100 notebooks that I'd filled with things I'd witnessed. I got very lost in it. By 1991, I was hugely depressed, to be honest, until I finally figured out a way to construct the narrative that I thought worked.
What was the depression like for you when you got really depressed about not being able to do the book?
I spent an awful lot of time supine on the couch in my office trying to figure it out. It was really grim. We had difficulty paying bills, and I remember winter time going down and looking at the gas meter as the furnace was on, the meter twirling around and around, and thinking to myself, "My God, how are we going to pay for this?" I in fact applied for a job around here as a night proofreader at a place, and I got rejected. I got a form rejection.
How did you take it?
It looked to me like nothing was ever going to go right. Plus, I saw this thing happening, this kind of... Schlickman spent 8 years on the case. I was spending about 8 years writing it. He hadn't gotten anything out of it, and didn't look like I was going to get anything out of it either in the end.
Well, in fact, you know, the book has, you know, gotten a lot of acclaim. It was on Time Magazine's 10 Best list of 1995, Entertainment Weekly's Book of the Year. And then Robert Redford has bought the screen rights to it, and he, I think, intends on playing the lawyer, Schlickman, who's the main character in the way you've told this story. It strikes me, you know, like that's the ultimate happy ending now in America, you know, that Redford or somebody likes buys the screen rights and stars in the made-for-TV version of your life or your book.
It does. It's a happy ending for me. You know, you write a book, and if you're lucky, a couple of 100,000 people, that's a lot, end up reading it. You do a movie, and if only a couple of million people come to see it, it's a failure. Movies are for better or for worse, the popular culture of America today. And for me, in any event, it was a happy ending. I don't think I could ask for anybody better than Redford to do this. He has a concern about the environment, and... the movies he's made have been quite extraordinary to my mind.
One last question. Do you want your next project to be a pretty short project, one where there's like no danger of sinking into quicksand?
I'd like my next project not to take 8 years. I can guarantee you that.
Jonathan Haar, author of the book A Civil Action. We spoke before his book won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shirock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.